This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Presented by OnX Hunt, creators of the most comprehensive digital mapping system for hunters. Download the Hunt app from the iTunes or Google Play Store. Know where you stand with OnX.
All right, everyone. Take two on not making the show the way we're supposed to make it. We're all sitting there all tight, smelling each other across the podcast studio table. We're remote again. So quarantine episode part two. But I do got a piece of good news. I just got an email about this morning that I don't know if you know, but the Trump administration has done a number of things around access enhancement. And that could mean a thousand things, right? Access is real popular. All people that hunt and fish and recreate are like the idea of access or voice the idea that they like access. And access can mean different stuff, right? So I've heard people take the access argument, being like access enhancement, and use that as a way to say we should carve up our wilderness areas with roads in order to give us more access in our trucks. So you can take it different ways. But this is like good access, where they got a plan. They're just rolling out a new plan here, which would, it's a proposal, which would expand hunting and fishing opportunities across more than 2.3 million acres at 97 national wildlife refuges. So there's always been a lot of refuges where you can hunt and fish, or hunt and or fish. And they're trying to roll that out, and also pushing to roll out hunting and fishing opportunities on some fish hatchery lands. So this is just like taking existing lands and getting it so you can use it for, you know, pursuing your activities in places where maybe you can't, but it doesn't really make sense why you're not allowed to. What they look at is distinct new hunting and fishing opportunities. And the way they define this is to be a species at a field station in a state. So for instance, if you opened up, you had a refuge, and a refuge had a bunch of largemouth bass on it, and you opened up the refuge in Delaware for largemouth bass, you're creating a distinct new hunting and fishing opportunity, meaning at a specific refuge, you're allowed to catch a specific fish in a specific state. They're projecting that this proposed rule would create 900 distinct new hunting and fishing opportunities.
Wow.
On top of last year, we had access expansion of 1.4 million acres. Now, I'll be the last guy to say that everything that's, every administration's got its things it does right and its things it doesn't do right. But in terms of access enhancement, in making areas that you previously weren't able to hunt and fish open for hunting and fishing, these guys are doing a pretty good job there. I just got a bumper sticker. A guy sent me that says ice fishing is not a crime, and it's meant to look like the, yeah. And you remember the skateboarding is not a crime,
buddy. My bumper sticker. My mom's Buick Skylark of era, probably like 88, had one of those stickers on it.
Yeah, this guy, he's connected somehow to Harvard University, and he invited us on our live tour. Our dates keep getting postponed because of COVID-19. He already had a ticket to go to our show, and our show in the Boston area, and he was inviting us that we could come tour Harvard. But he was pointing out that he had to make ice fishing is not a crime bumper stickers because ice fishing is so unfamiliar to the people in his area that when people see someone out on the ice, their first impulse is to call the police. Which I haven't dug into it much, but I thought it was funny. I almost put it on the podcast studio window, but we're not there, so I'm not able to do that. I don't know what the hell to do with the thing now. Follow up on another question. Oh, go ahead, Yanni.
I was going to say mine's on my freezer. That's where my sticker collection lives these days.
on your home freezer. Yeah. You know, maybe that's what I'll do, because no one's going to take your damn freezer from you. This hasn't gone that far yet. Another quick follow-up on a past conversation. We were talking about, Yanni, who are we talking about? A dude told a story about his dad's blood transfusion, and I was incredulous about how could you give someone 14 units of blood.
That's right.
When the human body, like your body only holds 8 to 12, quote, units
yep.
of blood. So how do you give someone 14 units of blood? Mm-hmm. It's like they'd overflow and it all run out their ears.
Yeah, which is, are you talking, because a couple of people wrote in to clarify that.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So what was there was a good analogy that someone used.
Well, a surgeon wrote in, he's done a lot of trauma surgery. And he was saying it's real common to use that much blood, and they use what's called a massive transfusion protocol. And he said they keep bringing in little red Coleman Lunchable type coolers containing a combination of packed red blood cells, fresh frozen plasma, and platelets. There's 6 units in a cooler. And you just keep pumping those things in until the bleeding stops. And he says his personal high, he had a patient. The guy actually lived. He ran, he'd been shot in the gut with a .45. And the surgeon ran 72 units of blood through that dude.
Whoa.
He had injuries to his aorta, his inferior vena cava, which I don't know what that is, his left renal artery, which I don't know what that is, plus some other stuff. The whole time they're trying to fix him, like when you take your, you'd have to like take a valve off or whatever on blood vessels. And dude bled so much that they gave him, what is it again? Your body holds 8 to 12, and they ran 72 units of blood through the dude after getting shot by a .45. A doctor named Sam out of Amarillo, Texas. This other guy wrote it on the blood thing. He had this to say. He talks about how he's a good blood donor. And he's got a kid who has Down syndrome, and they had some other complicating health problems, and the kid had to have an open heart surgery. He's got good insurance, but he said the itemized bill for the surgery came out to $200,000. And he went through the itemized list, and they had a single unit of blood ready for him in a cooler, a little lunch cooler, Igloo lunch cooler, that the kid never even needed because the surgery went well, apparently. But on the itemized list, that unit of blood that you donate, when you need it back, it comes at a price tag of $827.
I was just wondering how much one of those was.
Yeah. A couple more good things. We were complaining. I think like Cal was complaining about this. Like with all these questions going on right now, like what's an essential service and not an essential service? And we were talking about how could it be that you could close like a fishing access site down, but a liquor store could remain open? Like who determines what's serious or what's essential, and how can booze be essential? And a social worker wrote in, and he says he works in addiction services. He says when people detox, it can be real ugly. And detoxing often requires a hospital bed. With anticipations of hospital beds being in short supply, we don't want folks detoxing right now. Right now, we're focusing on harm reduction. Basically, trying to help people stay safe while drinking. They'll sort out the addiction issues down the road. He also pointed out a revenue issue in trying to minimize the economic chaos, right? You know, a lot of restaurants, alcohol pays the bills, or I'm sorry, you know, beer pays the bills, liquors allows stay open, or whatever that mantra is in the restaurant business, meaning restaurants without alcohol sales business gets very difficult. And in trying to minimize the chaos here, it can be helpful to allow restaurants to do to-go booze and things in order to help them stay solvent, right, and keep food flowing in a time of like very stressed situations.
Yeah, we heard about that too, right? Because I think Cal had included that in his statement there, that one of the states had thrown that in and he didn't understand why, but obviously that's why.
Yeah, and this dude, was writing in about that. And the ongoing debate, I'll interrupt these updates here to tell what we have on the beautiful and lovely Evan Hafer, right? Is that how you say it? Hafer.
It's close enough, yeah.
From Black Rifle Coffee Company. We met, I was emceeing. Turns out I don't feel like, and my wife pointed this out to me, that I'm not she feels that I'm not going to make it into the MC Hall of Fame. Everyone has their talents, she pointed out, but she doesn't know that I'm a gifted MC. I'm like a functional MC. Like, I get it done, but I get it done without a lot of fanfare. Anyways, I was emceeing at the National Wild Turkey Convention, the National Wild Turkey annual big blowout convention in Nashville, and I met Evan Hafer there. And then we became kind of like email friends recently.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the first time I've been out there. So that was a great event. It was huge. I didn't realize it was that big.
No, it's huge. So, did you take in any of my emceeing, or were you just backstage and doing stuff the whole time?
No, I was down in the crowd. I was taking in the MC. Did you think
to yourself, man, this young man really has emceeing dialed?
Yeah, I was. That's exactly what I was thinking the entire time. I didn't think about much else. I was just, this is impressive.
Steve, what'd your wife say your weak points were? MC weak points?
That I didn't do a lot of the I didn't do a lot of the really sort of corny drumming up, you know, like drumming up enthusiasms. It was more I did more of it. It felt more transactional. That was her takeaway. We have, Evan, now that we brought you into the conversation here, we're doing our rundowns.
Yeah.
We have an ongoing debate, and you probably have some feedback on this because you spent time in the special forces, and we'll talk about that. But we have an ongoing debate about whether or not a real man or a real woman can wear flip-flops. Like, because my buddy Ronnie Bame feels that you're not ready to defend your family in flip-flops. And feels it, like, he's like, when I have flip-flops on, I ask myself, well, what if there is a volcano?
Right.
What will that mean for my feet? What will that mean for my family? And so we have a lot of people write in. Like, we had a guy one time, his wife got assaulted by a rat, and he was able to kill the rat with a flip-flop.
Right.
But, because he could get it off quick.
Yeah.
This guy just got caught up in the earthquake there. He's in Boise. Got caught up in the earthquake. He was running around his house in his flip-flops, and he got to worrying about the structural integrity of his house and went to book outside, and on his way outside, tripped in his flip-flops and then made it outside. And here he is, the world's falling apart. He thinks his house is going to fall down. You know, the Yellowstone volcano might erupt, and he's outside in his flip-flops now, and it made him think that this is not an appropriate footwear for American living.
I should put
it to you.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I know a couple guys out there that they always point out that the Afghans have been fighting wars and in flip-flops for, you know, since the 80s. So when they talk about combat footwear, they think about the Afghans fighting, you know, the Soviets, and, you know, you've got all these other factions in Central Asia that have been fighting wars for decades in flip-flops. So they're always like, it's combat footwear. It's kind of a joke, actually. it's kind of a joke. It's interesting that you brought that up, because it is a debate even internally. Whereas if I wear a flip-flop, I'm typically, I know that it's because I'm in a boat, or I'm in the water and it's recreation time. I don't typically wear them as casual footwear. But my partner, Matt, he wears them every day. I've actually barely seen him wear shoes. So it's an internal debate over here, too.
Do you guys have a company policy, no flip-flops?
No, we have a company policy, which is carry your firearm most of the time, but that's typically the only company policy we really adhere to.
And if you want to do it in flip-flops, that's your business.
You do it, you know, and I think most guys are more concerned with, how fast can they react? And so they try to become as proficient as they can in their footwear. That's kind of their mentality. So they wear them all the time
to stay trained.
Stay in the mindset. Yeah, stay in the mindset.
Another thing, we recently had the Turkey Doctor on. That's a great show. What was the name of that episode? Do you guys remember?
Gobble Your Ass Off, was that it?
Oh.
Yeah, sounds right.
Yeah.
Go back and listen to that one. After that, Jared Oakley, he's kind of a friend of the show. His brother, he's a conservationist, works with mule deer. His brother works with Mexican gray wolves. Anyways, he wrote in, he was talking about hunting in the Black Hills of Wyoming. He found what looked like a bear shit, like a large boar, not B-O-A-R, like not like a large boar male. I mean, large boar, like large caliber.
B-O-R-E.
Large caliber bear shit. And he got to inspecting it, as one does, and saw that it had a white coating on it, that white frosty coating that you see on bird shit, which I always think resembles that the white mold that you get on good Italian salami. But he says the biggest bird shit he'd ever seen. He got to talking later to an expert on turkeys. I don't know if you guys ever heard of John Hutto. I think, I don't know how he pronounces his name. Hutto, I think. He's that guy that lived with turkeys. He raised up turkeys and learned how to communicate with them, and he talks about that he believes there are... It really changed his viewpoint on hunting a fair bit. I think right now he's living with some mule deer, but he lived with turkeys for a long time and learned... He feels that he's identified 27 vocalizations that turkeys make or something. He's got a lot of interesting stories about turkeys, but learned to communicate with them, and you kind of got to watch his own story of it. Hutto. Interestingly, he's married to the singer Rita Coolidge. But Jared Oakley was asking about these giant turkeys, which he called ass goblins. And it says that when a hen's sitting on her nest, it sees that they don't want to defecate. I should ask the turkey doctor about this, but they don't want to defecate near their nest because it increases the odor, right? And it could be attractive. It could attract predators. So they build up these giant deuces and then wander off and drop these giant deuces, which are the size of bear scats. What do you think of that, Giannis?
It might be Joe Hutto.
That's what I said, right?
Oh, I thought you were saying John. My bad.
Oh, yeah, I could have said that. Jared Oakleaf was the guy, our friend that wrote in. Joe Hutto, I'm sorry.
Sounds very possible. Sounds like what I would do if I was sitting on a nest, hiding, not wanting to go off just to drop a deuce, stay low key, hold it for a few days.
Yeah. Another, we talked about this before, but another word for that would be to take a growler. You know, another quick note before we get started here. Oh, two things. And one of these is going to be great for Evan. The first one, I don't know if this is up Evan's alley or not, but you know, we talk a lot about Bergman's rule or Bergman's principle. Phil the engineer, you know what Bergman's principle is?
I don't know.
So when you're working on the shows, you're not actually listening to anything anybody's saying.
I think that Bergman's maybe hasn't been mentioned since Phil started.
Dude, it's the main thing I talk about.
I do not recall ever hearing about it.
Okay.
So maybe you're right, or maybe Yanni's right.
For anyone who's ever wondered, why is it that white-tailed deer in Florida are real dinky and white-tailed deer in, say, Alberta have big, huge bodies? Why is that? Well, Bergman's rule is this thing, or Bergman's principle is this thing that mammals, when you look at a mammal's range, okay, and you imagine its range from north to south, when you look at an animal's range, you will find that within its range, it will tend to have a bigger body the more north you go. So within its range, smaller specimens live in the south, larger specimens live in the north. We're talking about body size here. It's believed, like a way to explain this, is that it has to do with heat retention and heat dissipation. being that the a let's say this, a 200-pound person has less surface area. So a 200-pound human has less surface area than a 150-pound human, meaning the measurement of your body that's exposed to the air relative to the mass of the body is less. So those bodies are better able to retain body heat. When in the South, where it's hotter, smaller bodies tend to have greater surface area, so they have greater ability to shed body heat. And someone pointed out, as much as I like talking about Bergman's rule, he pointed out there's also Allen's rule. And Allen's rule is interesting. I'd never heard of it. It's that animals have longer extremities in hot climates. You take the antelope jackrabbit and think about that. And what's interesting there is it points out that I think it's true that the mule deer defies Bergman's rule. That the mule deer, there's a lot of confusion where you have some larger specimens of mule deer in more southerly latitudes. And so it's an exception to Bergman's rule. But I think when you look at their ears, I think that they adhere to Allen's rule in terms of length of ear and how much you're putting out for heat dissipation. Last one. This is one where Evan can feel helpful. We had a debate. We've been having a debate. It goes on where we're talking about accidental discharges. And Evan, if I'm not mistaken, in the military, they train you up. I know in the Marines, they pound it into your head.
Oh, yeah.
There's no such thing as an accidental discharge.
No, it's negligent discharge.
Okay, a guy decided to challenge that, and he's from the Air Force.
Well, of course.
Okay. Well, hear him out. Hear him out.
Okay.
They're on a firing line.
Okay.
They were getting ready to deploy, and they were going through some tactical exercises. They were firing M16s, and they had fired dozens of rounds in the last few minutes. Barrels are hot.
Yep.
They finish another round of shooting but still have loaded rifles. The range instructor tells everyone to point the rifles down to the ground and downrange. But one guy didn't get the downrange part and only got the down to the ground part. All of a sudden, blouch! Gunshot goes off.
Right.
He looks over and a guy just falls down in a way that he thinks the guy just somehow killed himself or killed their neighbor.
Right.
But it turns out he'd only shot himself in the foot and then instantly passed out is why he looked like he was why he went down so hard.
Right.
Everybody laid their weapons on the ground to give first aid. And his rifle, which was now a few feet away on the gravel and pointed downrange, went off again on its own. And pointed out that it turns out the weapon had cooked off around. The barrel got so hot, it ignited the round without trigger pull.
Right.
They found the cartridges. They did not have dents in the primer. But there was a bulge where it had been pressed against the bolt.
Right.
The pressure of the round going off on its own had pushed the brass into the hole on the bolt where the firing pin lives. So actually like an inverted dimple. So he says, basically put that in your pipe and smoke it when it comes down to negligent discharge. But he points this out, just reminds you, watch where your muzzles are pointed at all times.
Yeah, kind of, right? So there's something called a negligent discharge. And obviously, when you don't point your weapon at anything you don't seek to destroy, right? That's one of the rules of handling a firearm. So you never point it in anywhere but a safe direction. So he was false in that because he's pointing it at his foot. Two, I've heated a lot of barrels in my day. Like I've sent hundreds of thousands of rounds downrange, and that doesn't happen very often. However, it is something that as the training NCO, the guy, the non-commissioned officer that's in charge of your block of training, they have to be conscious of how many rounds are being put through the barrels and what time frame. So I would say the negligent discharge wasn't actually owned by the shooter. It was owned, and the responsibility of that was on the guy that was in charge of the range. That's where I would say that was a negligent discharge. But the ownership is passed on to the person that's in charge and allowing the weapons to get too hot, because that shouldn't have happened.
Yeah, you know, I feel like I editorialized a little bit now that I'm looking at his email more carefully. I should point out, in this gentleman's defense, he did not say, put that in your pipe and smoke it. In fact, he just kind of says, like, watch where your gun's pointing.
Right. Well, put that round in your foot. I don't know if that works, but it's probably not. Maybe in that circumstance you could
say. He also said the Air Force ended up pulling lots of ammo out of operation due to the incident.
Hmm. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. So, I mean, all the ammo, all the barrels and things like that. Now, all these things inspections can fail. So depending on how the equipment was, the prior maintenance of the equipment, the inspections of the equipment, you know, where were the rounds coming from? Were they, you know, depending, there's a lot of variables there, but ultimately don't point your weapon at anything you don't seek to destroy, and don't heat up your rifles to the point they're going to cook off rounds. It's pretty, I've literally put on hundreds of courses with thousands of guys at this point, and I've not cooked off a round on a range with a rifle.
But Evan, you're familiar with this thing called cooking off a round.
Oh yeah. 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 When your barrels are too hot, what'll happen is a lot of these, and depending, right? Because if you're using suppressors or not using suppressors, your barrels will get really hot and they'll start to smoke. So it's not the smoke from the discharge of the round. It's cooking the surface of the barrel. At that point, you run a lot of different risks, right? You run a lot of different risks on the barrel itself, your firearms, your hands are going to be, they're going to be hot as hell. You're going to have to use a glove to hold on to your rifle, depending on what you're shooting. Your hand guards are in place on an M16, M4, depending on the variable they're using. They're in place to protect your hand from the heat of the barrel. But at that point, your barrel's hot.
That's an interesting point. Yeah.
Your barrel's so hot that your hand will not be able to maintain, even through a glove. If you get a barrel that hot to cook rounds, you're going to feel the heat coming off that barrel through the hand guards and through your glove. Somebody should have stopped that training iteration well before that happened. But, you know, it's easy for me to armchair quarterback it from my, you know, comfortable office here in San Antonio.
No, I like it, man. That's good insight. Yeah. When my dad would reminisce, he had a certain stories from World War II that he liked to tell and tell again. And when people, on the subject of urine, human urine, he would often reminisce about how much he disliked the smell, or how much he associated the smell of piss with pissing on overheated barrels.
Oh yeah.
In the military, and the distinct odor that made, and that it kind of turned him off to piss smell, hot piss smell.
I know that smell, not from pissing on firearms, but from pissing on my muffler. You know, pulling over and trying to find the wheel well, and like just burying yourself in because you got a long road trip and you can't find a place to pull off and get a cover. So I just go in on that rear wheel well of the truck.
I've lately adopted the really old manny thing you do, where you open your door and just kind of wedge in there.
Yeah.
Kind of wedge. So you're standing.
Yeah.
You know, like you look like you're trying to like look like a person who, I don't know what the hell you look like you're doing. Like you're contemplating whether to get in or out of your truck.
Yeah.
And you take a piss there.
Yeah.
I was doing that the other day and almost got busted by someone. I was at a river access and almost got busted by someone who came in around and caught me through my own passenger window. But I pinched her off and didn't have an issue. That brought up a thing a guy recently wrote in where he was saying like a hot tip for ice fishing. He says, if your hole is freezing up and you think peeing on it will thaw it out, don't do it. You just wind up with a frozen hole covered in frozen piss. Evan, now when you're when someone's like, "Hey man, what the hell's Black Rifle Coffee Company?"
Yeah,
like why that? What do you tell them?
Why not? You know, like, what did Sir Edmund Hillary? I think he said, yeah, they asked him, "Why'd you climb Everest?" Because it was there. You know, I don't know. I the Genesis story is not very long, and it's really not that complex because I'm not that smart of a guy. But I was teaching firearms and roasting coffee, my previous profession. So I was teaching close quarters combat and advanced pistol marksmanship to a bunch of former special operations guys. And I would have this 1 pound, called a fluid bed roaster, which is really just hot air. It's an elaborate popcorn popper, essentially. And I was roasting coffee and teaching firearms at the time.
But roasting it for personal use?
Yeah, and for the courses that I was teaching. So guys would come through. I would get 24 to 12 guys every few weeks, and I would roast coffee for the courses. And
just as a nice gesture.
Yeah, that's all it was for. Just I had a couple buddies that I would ship it out to, but most of the time it was just because I was interested in roasting coffee. It was my hobby for a long time. I loved it. And I had my service rifle literally on the tailgate of the G-Ride, the government vehicle. And I had a 1 pound fluid bed coffee roaster on the other side. I looked at those two things, put the two words together, Black Rifle, because that's essentially, it was just this dirty Black Rifle from being used on the range, and coffee. Merged those two things, and there's Black Rifle Coffee Company. That was it. It managed to create an image in a lot of people's minds. So if you're anti-Black Rifles, that obviously would kind of incite some feeling of negativity. I wasn't really thinking of that at the time, though. I was just looking at my service rifle. I was very naive, even to the Pro 2A community and some of those other things. I was super naive. I was just looking at my service rifle and looking at my coffee roaster going, two things look together, you know?
I've told this story a bunch of times, but when we were making a show, I was reading a lot of books to my new kid, a very young kid, and he liked dinosaur books, and you'd always get to the T-Rex,
right?
And it'd be like, this ferocious meat eater, right? Or you'd get to like a grizzly bear part of a book or whatever, and it'd be like, this meat eater is the king of the mountain,
right?
And I was like, I kind of like that word. I just like that word. Yeah. But I hadn't thought of the full implication. And then later it became like, later it's often understood by people that you're sort of making a dietary suggestion,
right?
Or that you're like the meat eater, right? When it was just meant to be like this sort of like, it was meant to be this kind of like classification of animals.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't blind to the way it would work, but it wasn't like a really well thought thing. It was just, it seemed like a cool word. You know?
It is a cool word. It is like, it's, rolls off the tongue. They're balanced. You know, it's a cool word.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a cool logo, but it's the same thing. People go, I didn't hire a marketing company. I didn't really have any idea as to even how to market a product, to be honest with you.
Did you have a lot of people tell you as you're starting your business, did you have a lot of people tell you that you better change the name?
Every day. Today,
oh yeah. Even today. Yeah. We hear it every day.
Yeah.
And ours isn't as pugnacious as yours at all, but we still hear, you know, we have a book coming out, Wilderness Skills and Survival book. And we just heard from someone affiliated with, you know, that our name in there could be divisive, you know?
Yeah. So. I hear it all the time. It's just, you know, people, they'll DM me or something, or I, you know, where I hear it a lot is from people that don't know me and they're were introduced in public places somewhere, and you'll be sitting there with a group of people, and you'll have somebody typically from the corporate world that has, you know, way more degrees than they have intelligence, and they'll say something like, well, how are you going to capture the entire market with a company name like Black Rifle? And instantly I just kind of want to say, you know, I don't care, you know, and typically that's what I say. Like, I don't care. I'm not that concerned. Well, how can you not be concerned? You know, that's typically their reaction to it's like, I'm just not that concerned, man. I was roasting coffee in my garage. Like, this is bigger than I thought it was going to be when I was doing it. This is way bigger than it is now. I'm more concerned with, you know, other things than capturing the entire coffee market and, you know, working with a bunch of backslapping, pleated, Docker wearing, you know, back nine D-bags. Like, it's not my thing. It's not my thing.
I need to get a t-shirt that says that on it. You grew up in Idaho, right?
Yeah. I grew up in someplace I'm sure you're familiar with, Lewiston, Idaho.
Oh, yeah. Well,
yeah. Yeah.
Did you grow up hunting and fishing?
I did. Yeah. Yeah. My dad actually, both sides of my family, mom's side, my dad's side, I grew up in a smaller logging town. When you go up the Clearwater on Highway 12, as you're probably familiar with, up and over the Lolo Pass, there's a really small town, a logging town up there called Weipe, Idaho.
Yeah.
My family's from.
Yeah.
Weipe Prairie, actually. And then we moved to Lewiston later in life. And I spent more time fishing early on than I did hunting. I would go out hunting with my grandpa, my dad, both. But I was way more interested in fishing from an early age. I was a nerd. You know, like I was, when I say, you know, nerd, I was the guy building a fly rod when I was 12, when all my other friends were, you know, wanting to do skateboarding. And, you know, I was like, I'm super interested in doing this, trying to build this fly rod. I'm sure that you guys are very similar to that.
You spent a lot of time on the river.
I did. I've spent, I would say the majority of my recreation adult life has been on rivers. That's where I would classify I'm at home, and I feel the most comfortable outside of my home as in the river.
You know, I feel like you said this to me, your mom or your dad was Jewish, right? Are you?
My dad, yeah. He's Jewish ancestry.
How did he wind up? What was the line? How did he wind up in the logging community there?
It's a family tradition. I think my great grandfather was actually a sheep herder.
Was that right? Really?
Yeah, they were sheep herders. And then my grandfather was logging only because that's where they landed. So my grandfather, my dad's dad, we disconnected from our entire family tree at that point. He moved out west, and we didn't really know anyone past my grandfather. So he had moved out to Idaho when he was like 12 or 13. He'd taken like a train from Colorado or New Mexico. And
just striking out on his own.
Yeah. Yeah. They had something like, you know, 80 kids or something.
Yeah.
At the point, and he struck out and he landed in a small logging town, which was Weipe, Orfino, that whole area in northern Idaho. And so we didn't really, we weren't practicing or anything like that. It was something that I found later in life where, you know, through 23andMe and a bunch of, putting the pieces all together, because my dad used to say, oh, we're German. And then it was, oh, he'd have some other names for it. But it was pretty easy for me to piece it all together, because I went to Jerusalem later in life, and I knew by that time, even before 23andMe came out, 23andMe just confirmed the genetics test, basically.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah.
How did you get into your head growing up the way you grew up and where you grew up? Did you guys have, like, how did you get in your head you wanted to go to Green Beret School? I mean, were you a military family?
No, it's super easy. As guys that were outdoor, you guys are outdoorsmen. I spent every waking moment. I went to the University of Idaho, which is in Moscow, every weekend, every morning, and then if depending on what, Steelhead Run was in, it was how active I was going to participate in classes, basically. And I spent the majority of my high school and college days in the outdoors. I was kind of introduced to Green Berets through a friend, and I loved being in the outdoors. I love being in the mountains. I love being in the outdoors. And I thought, well, I also want to jump out of planes. That's pretty interesting. The Green Berets mission is by, with, and through. So they're working with host national forces to do essentially covert action, which is direct action. That's, to me, that was really adventurous. It was super cool. It was something I could spend all my time like in jungles and mountains, wearing a rucksack and living out of it. And then also, jumping out of planes and potentially going to war. Nobody really had to convince me too hard. It was a pretty easy connect for me as far as being able to look at my life in Idaho and say, how do I spend my adulthood outside and doing these high adventure things? And then two, I wanted to learn, and I was kind of in love with this image of, to be a Green Beret, they're called snake eaters, and they'll eat things to make a billy goat puke and all this stuff. And I was like, man, I want to be the ultimate survivalist. I'm gonna be able to just like go out with nothing but a loincloth after I'm done with this, and like a knife, and just survive off the land, which is total horseshit. But that's kind of at 18 years old. That's kind of what I wanted to do, and it wasn't a hard sell. It was as easy as soon as I was done with college, I was off and wanted to do that.
Were your parents pissed or supportive, or
they didn't really know? They didn't really know what it was. I don't even know if my mom today even really knows what a Green Beret does or is. She just knows like my son was in the military. He worked for the CIA for a while. I think she might have even thought that the CIA was the Culinary Institute of America for a while.
Well, you like to roast coffee.
Yeah. My dad was like, once he found out that that's what I wanted to do, I think he probably pulled me off to the side and was like, well, don't get your hopes up, get ready to be disappointed or something like that,
Because you wouldn't be able to make it through the courses?
Yeah. I don't think my dad ever looked at me as like a really hard kid at, 18 years old. So I think he was more looking at it like, dude, Don't really get your hopes up too high.
Did you struggle through the elimination course?
No. I'd spent most of my time backpacking and just kind of suffering. I loved to kind of do these endurance events before endurance events were cool. I liked the aspect of suffering. I wanted to kind of go through this hero's journey, for a lack of a better term. I was in love with that process, and there was never a time, I've heard that people always say, well, there's always a time when you would have thought about quitting or something like that. Like, I never thought about quitting. I was concerned about my body quitting on me, can I walk another step? Am I going to collapse from heat exhaustion or, sleep deprivation? I was concerned about that. So it was a very conscious thought as to where does my body end its physical performance, right? And I never found that. I don't know. It's very difficult to find that, I would imagine. I haven't found it yet.
A friend of ours who was in the Navy pointed out that in the SEAL elimination, or what do you guys call it? Not elimination course, but the
buds,
the tryout, whatever that.
Yeah.
He was saying that the strategy there is to use cold water.
Yeah.
And PT.
Mm-hmm.
What do they use on you guys?
Well, they
like cold water and PT to break you down, you know, or to find your limit, right? Mm-hmm. So, but with you, it's not cold water, I'm guessing.
No, a lot of it is built on you have to be alone in the woods under a rucksack for a long period of time. So it's a map, it's a compass, it's 60 plus pounds of weight in a rifle, and you're walking from point to point to point. That's part of it. A lot of people are really uncomfortable being in the woods at night. A lot of people, there's psychologically, it's a really easy thing to start chopping away the fat. And then two, you know, as you guys know, like navigating with a map and compass is a difficult thing. To be good at it and to hit your points on time, and as you're running through the mountains with a map in one hand, you're dead reckoning portions of it. You're trying to hit your times. And if you don't hit your times, you're going to be eliminated. So that's part of it. The other aspects of it are how do you work as a team? So they do what's called team events. So Special Forces Assessment and Selection, they have, it's about 3 weeks plus before you can even get into the course, they have a pre-course, which is a 20 some day course that puts you through a bunch of different performance standards, land navigation, team events, and then you get into the course. The course, so you lose, we'll say 70 plus percent on the first 20 some days. Then if you get accepted into the course, you lose another 70 plus percent. It takes you 2 years. It took me year and we'll call it 9-10 months just to get a Green Beret. So it takes a long time and it's different. So when you look at other special operations units and what they're selecting for, each one is selecting for a very specific mission set, a type of person for that mission set. They have very similar, the Special Operations Command and the Joint Special Operations Command, they have similar sleep deprivation selection criteria. So they can only keep you up, I think, don't hold me to this, but it's about 3.5 days. You can stay, they at some point in the course, whether you're a Green Beret or a Navy SEAL or a Force Recon Marine or whatever it might be, they're going to keep you up for about 3.5 days before they put you down for about 10 minutes of sleep, give or take. Because they'll cause permanent brain damage if you go past something like 4 days or something like that. I was talking to a special operations psychologist about this several years ago. And he's like, everybody has the same sleep deprivation standard. Like everybody has to do the sleep issue. And sleep is the single worst thing for, I think, to go without. It hurts your body. It just hurts your body to go through intense physical activity with no food and no sleep. Psychologically, that is so difficult to work through problems and be a conscious team member and all these issues that you run into. It physically hurts to go without sleep, and then you pile in all the other things with that. It doesn't surprise me that the most of the people that try these courses, they just don't make it because it's devastating. Even to this day, I can do without sleep, but I don't like it. I do not like it. It's not something that I prefer whatsoever. And I've done it, I think, the majority of my adult life. But, you know, you take yourself 3 days and then put yourself down for a 10-minute nap and then do another day, 24-hour cycle, and then put yourself down for another 10-minute nap and then do it again, you're a wreck. You feel like you've been hit by a freight train.
Real quick, how much do you like to sleep now that that's all behind you?
Man, I wish I could. Like that. That is like one of the things that I really try. I have to be really disciplined with my sleep, routine. Because I was pre-built in this era of guys that used to refer to sleep as a crutch. It was repeated and beat into your head over and over and over and over again. You're going to sleep when you're dead. Sleep is a crutch. Sleep is not, it's not an option. I've had 2+ decades of that. It's only been in the last, I'll call it 2.5 years of my life where I have had to be extremely disciplined about getting 7 hours of sleep. And now I have to force myself to sleep more because I know the long-term health benefits and then the negative attributes of not getting it, right? I don't want to have dementia when I'm 60. I don't want Alzheimer's. You know, your recovery cycles are faster. There is such a big difference between 5.5 hours in me and 7.5 hours of sleep. See, it's miles of difference between performance, and especially when I've got all the responsibilities of the company and a few other things. I notice those 2 hours way more than I ever have. And more importantly, now I've got to think about it, concentrate, and work on getting more.
Yeah, that's well, I've been sleeping my ass off now because this, you know, all this quarantine stuff going on. I was telling my wife the other day, I feel like I'm getting soft, man. We've been sleeping at least 8 hours every night, which is like, I need to end it just because I don't want to have that become such an important thing for me. Well,
just what Evan said, you're going to do the opposite now.
No, dude. Well, hey, what year was all this going on that you were like, were you, give me the timeline relative to the 9/11 attacks.
I had graduated the Q course in the summer of 2000.
Oh, okay. So you were you were ready to roll.
Yeah. It's right after September 11th, a few months, I went to, the Philippines on our first rotation, which was a war on terror rotation. And then from the Philippines, I went to Kuwait in preparation for Operation Iraqi Freedom. And I did the invasion of Iraqi Freedom, which was March of 2003. So I was graduating and then going straight into the mix.
Did you spend a lot of time in Afghanistan as well?
Only about 2.5 years total, I would imagine, give or take. The majority of my time, because I was with Special Forces in the invasion of Iraq. And then I went to work 2005, late 2005 for the CIA. Then I spent the next 9 years there. So I was deployed the majority of my, from 2002 to 2014, the majority of those years, I was deployed either to Iraq or Afghanistan for give or take 250 plus days a year.
Is the work you were doing with this kind of, I'm anticipating this is a dumb question, but maybe I'll be surprised it's not a dumb question. Is the work you were doing with the CIA like fundamentally different than the work you're doing with the military? Was it just like a whole other skill set, or was it sort of a continuation of what you, skills you had acquired and were put into use?
It's a combination. As a Green Beret, you kind of learn a lot about the art of combat, and then you start to put it into practice in real combat, and then you start to develop and curate other skills that are in the combat environment. So not every one of your skills in combat is direct fighting, right? So it's not just taking task to the enemy. It's surveillance, counter-surveillance. It's asset management, so it's information collection. But you have to be proficient in operating in a combat zone because it's a unique environment. It's a lot like hunting. If you go out and hunt for the first time, and I mean, you guys think about yourselves if you've never hunted or you've hunted with a person that's never hunted before, their gear's all messed up. They walk too loud. They don't understand wind. It's a totally different experience.
Yeah.
Combat is so much, and living in a combat zone is so much like that. You have to learn the environment, and you have to kind of learn how to even survive in that environment. And then you can apply the skills of just survival to being able to thrive in that environment and then excel towards mission accomplishment or mission success. So it's a different set, but it requires the previous skills, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I imagine that you end up, you end up with an inordinate amount of time, feeling at risk. If you had to, when you imagine that all those years spent in war zones. Is the amount of time that you felt like that heightened sense of being at risk, is that, when you think about it now, is it, was it minutes? Was it hours? Was it years?
It's interesting because your body gets acclimated to it. And if you guys, have run like big rivers, I would imagine, or done really sketchy
well,
stuff,
a bit.
Right?
Yeah. I've done it. Yeah. I mean, not like you, but yeah, I've done stuff where we were very aware of very aware of risk.
So, but as you start to run and you get more proficient, your tolerance starts to go up because you're more proficient, you're more confident. And then you start going through stuff where you're like, ah, it's no big deal. Or you're doing a, you know, a climb, or you're roping off on something. You just kind of get a greater amount of tolerance towards risk. Your body starts to acclimate against it. And then you're only really heightened when you're being shot at. But even then, it's not like the first time you were shot at, if that makes sense.
No, I got you. Yeah.
So you just get used, your body starts to acclimate and adapt. So I got the best sleep of my life when I was downrange. We'd live in these shipping containers. I'd crank the AC unit and block off all the light, and I could sleep for 8-10 hours. I can't do that today. But it definitely is one of those things where the first couple of years, Baghdad, Iraq, and Ramadi, those places in 2005, 2006, it was so active all the time. There were car bombs and IEDs going off every day, and not just a little, just a few. These were really the most dangerous places in the world, and they were targeting Americans every day with complex attacks and IEDs. So you got used to being out in the city and fighting. I remember very distinctly sitting multiple times going, oh, that's not my gunfight over there, so I can just kind of watch it. Or that's not my ambush. I'm not in that ambush. So, which it's such a weird mentality when you think about it. I'd be on the road and it's not my ambush. All right, I'm going to be back here drinking coffee until this ambush comes to me, I guess. And, you know, those cities at those time frames, I don't know of any other more dangerous kind of work you could do in the more complex environment. Baghdad 05, 06, and Mosul, and where I was there in 08, 09, by far they were what I call the most spicy. They were the spicy cities of that country. And you're just living in it. You just kind of learn to adapt to your environment. You just live in it. If you think about it, it'll just eat you alive, and you won't actually be able to conduct your profession.
At what point, maybe it was all the time, did you start thinking like, man, when I'm done doing this shit, I'm gonna blank. Like, I'm just going to hunt and fish. That's it.
Yeah.
I'm going to start making roasted coffee. Like how do you, how did you become aware of the sort of afterlife? You know,
I didn't plan for past 30, which is always kind of a morbid thing for people to hear, but I didn't plan past 30. So past 30, I kind of had to develop a new plan. Oh, so if I'm going to be around for a while, I'm going to have to try to figure my shit out as an adult. And then I started having those thoughts. It wasn't until I met my wife where I decided that, and it was much later in life, I was like 36, 37. I wanted to have kids, and I wanted to have a family.
Did you always know you were going to have kids?
No. After 30, I didn't plan for anything. I thought that I truly didn't think that I was going to leave Iraq or Afghanistan.
You mean you didn't think you're going to leave alive, or you just thought that the war would go on forever?
No, I didn't think I was going to leave alive. I didn't make plans for post-military, post-CIA. And if I did, my thoughts were in what was I going to do as a special operations guy or a CIA guy at 40 or 50? Mm-hmm. It wasn't until probably 36, 37. And honestly, I was on the middle fork of the salmon. I'd just come back from Afghanistan. And the middle fork of the salmon is in the Frank Church Wilderness area, as I'm sure you're familiar with, because it's just west of you guys in Bozeman. And I'd rode down the river with my buddy, and I'd done two trips back to back. So I'd spent about 14 days on the river. And I realized, I was like, I've got to get out of the life that I'm in, and I've got to repatriate myself into the mountains. I had had such a long road in deserts and in places where people wanted to kill me. It was really hard for me to even unplug and enjoy the wilderness. And that was like, it was strange to me. It felt really, really foreign. And I didn't want to live with that anymore. I really didn't. When you're dead and you're callous and you can't enjoy, you know, snow-tipped ridgeline or, you know, a simple track somewhere, and you can't take enjoyment in those things. It took me about 14 days to kind of strip away that and realize I got to do something a little bit different with my life and get back to the things that I really, really loved. And it wasn't even 2 years past that point. It probably wasn't even 18 months. I started chopping everything away, and the agency, thank God, told me that they didn't want me to work for them either, and I didn't want to work for them. And it was like, it was perfect, which is a polite way of me saying that I got fired. But everybody gets fired from there, so I don't feel too bad about
it. It's normal to get fired?
Yeah. When I say it's normal, man, they have a, you know, it's an interesting place to work, but it's very political. I'm not a political animal. Like I can't survive in political environments. Mm-hmm. It's not something that I can do. I'm not a careerist. And I knew that, you know, I knew that. And so did the people working around me.
I'm curious when you say a political environment. What do you mean by that? Do you mean like politics, like politics, like how we understand politics to be, or do you mean like political, like in terms of people plotting and scheming?
I don't know. It's not even that. You've got two, and I think this is true with the corporate environment just in general. You've got people that are. And you guys understand this too. You got the mission first people that are all about accomplishing the goals of the company for the company with team effort and unity. Mm-hmm. You have people that are serving the country that are the most patriotic and driven people in America. And they need all the, you know, love and support and appreciation we can put onto them. Then you have the me first people. And these are people where, you know, maybe they were picked on as a kid or whatever, and they think that working for an acronym will make them a better person, right? So because I work at the CIA and I get this next promotion, that will define me as a human being. And so everything is about me and making sure that they're the ones that eat first. They're the ones that are, you know, promoted and are receiving the accolades. And you have the silent majority that are mission first. Unfortunately, the missions and the me's come in conflict a lot.
Because yeah, I got you.
They come into conflict a lot. And there's just a lot of, and that's just, I think, true in general with government bureaucracies at times when you have people that are more concerned with their career than they are with the mission and the men. And it's unfortunate, but it's true. But that's not the majority. It's definitely not the majority.
Earlier, we talked about getting interested in coffee, and you kind of just mentioned you like to roast coffee.
Yeah.
But how, in more detail, how did this whole thing happen? I mean, there's a lot of people that like to roast. There's a lot of people that like to roast coffee.
Yeah.
I'm not one of them, but I understand there to be a lot of them. And they don't all have a big coffee company now.
Which is weird because it's a whole other thing. My buddy and I were joking around. He's up here at the ranch with me. He's like, man, you're kind of seen as like the man now. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? It's like, you're kind of a bigger company. I'm like, I don't feel like it. I still feel like the same guy that was roasting coffee in my garage. But to go back, I started getting really into coffee because I loved coffee. And I started roasting it because I couldn't get fresh roasted coffee downrange. I could get this like old, stale, nasty coffee. I could get that shipped out. But I was like, you know what? I'll just buy a little roaster. It'll be a really cool hobby. You know, a lot of guys are, you know, they do random stuff where, you know, they're like fletching arrows or whatever they do, right? Like coffee roasting was somewhat like that for me. I would come home. I would experiment with a bunch of different roasts. I was learning about the profiles, and it allowed me to kind of completely disconnect from the profession I was into and just kind of dive into something that was a little bit more of a curated, I guess, interest that I could drink. And a lot of this was just being able to take coffees that I truly loved and take them with me. So I would have these epic cups of coffee that I would roast and spend a lot of time with. And I would take them out and, you know, be fly fishing in northern Idaho or Montana or somewhere. And I would be using my jet boiler, my MSR, or whatever it was. I'd make these like incredible cups of coffee. And then I would take that same roast profile and I would take it with me to Iraq, the shittiest place on earth, right?
Yeah.
And I would get up in the morning and have a cup of coffee, and it would remind me of, you know, the North Fork of the Clearwater or Kelly Creek, or, you know, it reminded me of these beautiful rivers that are amazing, and that experience that I had on the riverbank. But I could get that in the mornings in Iraq, and honestly, it would allow me a little bit of psychological comfort and a connection to home and those specific places that kind of just allowed me to continue to operate. And then I just got more and more interested in it.
When you're hanging out with all these, you're hanging out with all these war fighters, you know, and like super tough people, and you talked about learning how to suffer. Was there like a joke? I like coffee a lot too.
Yeah.
But was there the joke that it's kind of this like fussy sort of a feat? Like, were people kind of like, what? What?
Yeah, all the time, man.
There's a big difference between fletching arrows and roasting coffee.
Yeah. All the time. All the time.
So it didn't go unnoticed.
No, it didn't go unnoticed. It was a joke. It was like, Hafer is got this weird thing with coffee. But the thing of it is people could come over to where, you know, my little hooch was, and they knew, you know, one of my other buddies who's a great guy is former SEAL V Diamond. He and I were hardcore coffee heads, and we would make these little coffee, you know, areas in each one of our bases. Well, everybody likes good coffee. No, I don't know of anybody, unless they don't drink it, right? Everybody loves good coffee.
No, so I know a couple things. People that don't.
Yeah, in Utah, there's a few people that don't either, too.
No, I mean, I don't mean like that they don't like coffee, but for instance, my mother's husband just doesn't like, he drinks a lot of coffee, but he just insists on it being very, he likes Folgers and he likes it to look like tea.
That's like the old school. The guys that are from the old school, my grandpa would take these two, you know, those green Stanley thermoses and they just roll around the bottom of the truck, the F-150 in the mountains, and just, they're just beat. They got dents all over them. Almost all the green is rubbed off. They're almost like a shiny steel wool or stainless steel. My grandpa would make the same crap. You could look through the bottom of the top of the glass and see, you know, 12 inches below, you could see the bottom of the cup, right? It was horrible. It is horrible. So, but that's the old school. I know if I go anywhere, I've trained my dad to drink better coffee now. But if I go anywhere with my uncles, man, I can't even entertain the idea of opening up that Stanley and pouring a cup of coffee. It's just horrible. It's nasty.
I wonder where that originated, right? Because you still see it in like ranching communities.
Yeah.
Like if you just stop in at some random ranch house and they invite you in, like that's probably the cup of coffee you're going to get, right?
Oh, yeah.
Is it a Depression era thing where we can't use too much of this because we need it to last longer?
I would imagine. Yeah, I would imagine. The hardest guy I've ever met in my life was never a Green Beret or a Navy SEAL. He was a guy, Rusty Bentz, who's a guy from Lewiston, Idaho. The guy would only drink coffee as far as I know. I don't know if he ever even had a glass of water. He could run full sprint up the, and you guys know these guys, he could run full sprint up a ridgeline in White's boots after a cat with his dogs. And I would be, you know, I'm running like 50 miles, you know, 50 milers. I'm like a hardcore Green Beret, and he'd be putting me in the ground in the mountains.
On coffee. And
he's just running on coffee. He's like the hardest guy on the planet. He's 70 years old. He could probably still hunt me into the ground. You know what I mean? Like these guys, like the old school mountain guys that we've all, you know, come into contact with, like those are the hardest, some of the hardest people on the planet. And I don't know if they just survive on weak coffee, which is that's how they hydrate. But I don't know. I've thought about it a lot though, because those people are, there's a lot of hard people out there.
So
they're not SEALs.
Hit me with the basic chronology of how you went from hobby coffee roaster to like what was the first time you sold some, right? Like what was your first transaction?
Oh, that was 2014. I teamed up with my buddy Matt. He was making these stupid videos on the internet. We still do. I mean, that's what we kind of do. And he was working at the CIA. I was working at the CIA, and we were introduced to one another. And we both have a similar sense of humor, which is kind of messed up. And he's like, yeah, I've got this T-shirt company called Article 15 Clothing, which that's a reference to getting in trouble in the military. And, you know, maybe we should roast coffee. And I was like, yeah, let's roast some coffee for you. So I started roasting their coffee first. And so I roasted like 500 pounds of coffee for them. Then I said, you know what? I think I'm going to do this online. And I was really interested in figuring out, I didn't know how to build a website, didn't know how to do product photography, but I knew that I wanted to have a business that allowed me to explore coffee. That's really what I wanted. And so I built all of that stuff because I was fascinated with it. I took my product photos, built a website, you know, started tinkering around with how to market and put out even like really bad videos. And then I started selling coffee. Really, my first transaction was January 2015. It was my first official Black Rifle Coffee transaction.
And man, it's blown up since then.
Yeah, we have 228 employees.
That's incredible, man.
No, it's insane. Like, it's insane. Like, I'm, you know, I to come back from war, have all your fingers and toes. You know, I'm a really lucky guy. Like, I mean, I'm a very, very fortunate and lucky guy. For a laundry list of reasons.
What's your guys' policy on? I know you have shitloads of vets that work for you, but what's your is there a formal policy, or do you just try to lean that direction as much as you can lean that direction? Explain that all.
I sit at about 50% hiring rate for veterans. You know, as we've grown the company, I've had to pull in civilian help because they just know more about a lot of different things, especially when it comes to finance and operational efficiencies. So when we say it's our official, we do have a veteran's preference, and we try in the hiring process, if everybody's created equal in a resume, we try to put veterans in the chute against non-veterans in a more proficient way. So we understand how to read their resumes. We understand their work experience. And we might take on people that don't necessarily have the definitive qualifications for a role, but I might want to see them there in you know, 180 or 270 days, right? So we'll take on people that we just want to grow into those positions. So I'm trying to be more patient in the way that we hire. And then I want, you know, civilians to kind of adapt more to a military culture versus the reverse is true with most veterans, which is they sit at like, you know, 5%, give or take, in some companies, which is high for a lot of companies. But they have to adapt to civilian, when I say their lingo. We use a lot of acronyms out here. I do mission planning here for the company, and that's my corporate planning. So everybody has to adapt to the way that we do company planning, the way the military did it. We run military-structured meetings and briefings, which is kind of crazy for a lot of civilians because they're like, what in the hell are you guys doing? Like, we don't understand. I'm like, yeah, what do you think it feels like to be a new guy going into the corporate world, stepping into GE for the first time, and you've been, you know, running missions in Ramadi? You're trying to learn as fast as you can because you don't understand what they're talking about. What is a SWOT analysis? What are you talking about? What's a cost per, you know, acquisition? I don't know, right? So once you dial in your lingo and your recruitment piece, it becomes pretty easy that that's the way that we attract people and the people that we hire and put into positions.
You know, you just made an interesting point, man. I was looking at some resumes recently, and two of them, three counting Coast Guard, three of them had military experience. And it's funny you just mentioned that because I didn't even realize I wasn't able to do it. All it registered when there's the explanation,
right?
Okay, what they did for these years. All it registered in my head was military.
Right.
I had no way to look at it and be like, oh, yeah, I could picture that skill set. Right. And it was like, but now what I realized about myself is I didn't even give it the time to go find out, meaning any other job, any sort of job in the professional sector or whatever, private sector. I'd have looked and been like, oh, yeah, I could picture what that entails.
Right.
Like, I see that he or she must be proficient at X, Y, and Z to have done that. But with the military stuff, I'm like, oh, military. Cool.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
It's the same thing. If I was looking for a chief financial officer a couple years ago, and my partner had to explain to me even what a CFO did. So he's just like, hey man, I've got a great partner. I've got a couple great partners, but they've had to really unpack and organize information for me. And it's been extremely helpful because I can read a military resume 90% of the time. I can tell you plus or minus 10% efficiency, what that job really was, right? What there's the definition to what it is. And then what does it mean when you're actually executing on it? Whereas if you're a couple years ago, if you were to ask me to build a finance or an operations department, I would have been like, all right, man, I'm going to grab some people and hopefully they can help me figure it out. And that's kind of where my head's been the last few years. Like I said, I've been pretty lucky growing the company, to not have too many, you know, massive head injuries when it's been hiring people. But Still not without its mistakes, that's for sure.
Yanni's got a question for you. It popped up on my screen here. Please. Me and Yanni communicate through little messages.
I didn't even see him type. Are you just thinking?
Evan's on that same doc. Too,
Yanni developed
yesterday.
Yanni developed the ability just to think into
just
his
to
computer.
Think it?
Yeah. He's working on that software. Go ahead, Yanni.
I was going to ask just in your testing of making coffee,
yeah,
and trying to get the right brews and whatnot and just being a coffee connoisseur. Like, have you ever gotten to the point, cause you're drinking the regular old caffeinated coffee. Have you ever had too much and had a real issue?
Oh yeah.
From drinking too much coffee?
Yeah. About once a week, give or take. Plus, yeah, when you're really cupping a lot of coffee, so I'll go to country of origin. So I'll go to like Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, Colombia, wherever. And if you're cupping a lot of coffees, I've made those mistakes really early, which is you're trying the coffee. And you take a little spoon and you're dipping it in, you're you're aspirating it across your tongue to try to pick up all the different aspects of the coffee. Well, early on, you're supposed to spit that out as you're doing it, because if you're going to be doing it all day, man, that's just too much coffee. And these are typically lighter roasted coffees, which have more caffeine in them. Well,
Roasted has more caffeine.
Yeah, so a lighter roasted coffee has more caffeine than a darker roasted coffee.
Oh, sure. Dude, I've always make my call on how much caffeine I want by, I had to ask backward.
Yeah, it's super easy to think about because the bean itself, as you're applying heat to it, it's turning into carbon, right? So you're just taking away its integrity and you're putting it into charcoal, essentially. Because if you over roast it, you're pulling the beans going endothermic, so it's pulling in all this heat, and then it goes exothermic, so it's pushing it all out, and then eventually it starts to decompose from the heat, right? So the darker roasted coffee is less intact of the coffee bean itself, and it starts to take away a percentage of its caffeine as it gets darker roasted.
No kidding.
So, yeah, if you
Phil,
want
did you
caffeine,
know that? I bet Phil knew this.
Yeah, that's one thing
that's know. One of the stupid things Phil would know.
Oh, that's like Phil knows stuff like that.
Phil will surprise you, man. He knows a lot of stuff.
Not a Schlitterbahn's principle or whatever the thing is we were talking about earlier.
Bergman's principle and Allen's
Bergman,
rule.
Got it.
Oh, Phil, yeah. He's good. Go on.
So, and what was your question? I forget.
He's just wondering how often you drink too much coffee. Oh.
So early on when I was cupping this stuff, I would just drink it because I'm an idiot when it comes to some things. Kind of like the, you know, sleep is a crutch and some of these other things. I'm like, oh, I'm just going to drink this stuff. And your heart, I've had a few points where I think my heart might come beating out of my chest. And then what happens is you get too much and it makes you sleepy. So you hit a wall.
Oh, yeah, man. I know that wall well.
You know the wall. But you come back off the other side. What happens is you come back off the other side of the wall, for me at least, is, you know, you can't really drive through it. But, you know, you'll go sleepy and then sometimes I'll take like a 5 or 10 minute nap and then I'll come back out of it and I'm just as wired for just as long. So caffeine, obviously, it takes you a long time to metabolize it. I think it's up to 8 hours, depending on how much. So if you're drinking it all day, what I like to think is I can just acclimate myself to just crazy amounts of caffeine, and eventually I'll just power through it.
You know, Yanni, I don't know if you know this about old Yanni, but he can't drink regular coffee anymore because it's his ticker.
Really?
No, he's decaf only, man.
Are you decaf only?
Yeah, it triggers a severe ventricular tachycardia.
Really?
Yeah.
How long has that been going on?
I saved his life.
3 years.
3 years? You saved his life?
Yeah, I had to save his life one time.
How did you do that?
I had to drive him to the doctor.
Really?
Yeah, he's having heart trouble.
Wow.
He owes his life to me.
Wow.
Steve might be exaggerating the situation a little bit.
Who else is going to drive you down there? Yeah, I drove him all the way down there, middle of the damn night. with all the, what's your take on what's going on right now, man? Like with all the psychologically, you know, like with all the, I imagine that you had to learn how to deal with a lot of stress. Is business stress and family stress its own brand of stress, or is just, do you view stress as just stress?
No, it's his own. It's its own stress.
There are different brands.
Yeah. It's heavier. So depending on the type of stress, it carries more weight for me. So light stress, for instance, would be like a violent engagement, which sounds crazy, you know, be like, oh, violent, because it's you're in and you're out, right? Mm-hmm. You're done. Mm-hmm. The psychological weight of what's happening right now, because the cross-pollination of anxiety between all of these different aspects of your life, between the company, between your family, between you, like this is a big, heavy circumstance that I think we're all living in. it's heavier, two, it weighs more heavily on my psyche, which means I have to spend more time compartmentalizing different aspects. And then essentially what I do is I try to compartmentalize and then tick off priorities against how I can solve to decrease the load of stress, if that makes any form of sense.
No, it does. But I got you. But walk through it a step or two.
So from my perspective, you have concentric rings of responsibility that you have to ultimately take care of in order to be more effective as you move out. So myself, I have my internal stress, which is compounded by the family and then the business. So what I have to do is I have to say, okay, what are all the things that I can do individually to make sure that I'm taken care of, as far as, you know, did I get enough sleep? Am I eating correctly? Am I taking care of all the things that I need so I can be psychologically comfortable solving the more complex problems? Then, okay, what does my family need? My family needs stability. They need a plan. So that becomes finance. It becomes food. It becomes a laundry list of different items. They need leadership. When I say that, I've got to be plugged in a positive influence to the family. So I can't wait. I can't let any of these things affect me to the point where I'm not the cornerstone of responsibility for my family. And the way that I can do that is by plugging in and being positive every day, like, you know, propagating love and understanding that my kids and my wife need me to be the guy that's the catalyst to nothing but good, right? I can't bring any of this negative shit into the house. That's my responsibility. And then what I have to do is I have to balance that weight again and say, not only can I not bring any negative things in the house, I have to be the positive injection of influence across my entire family. So I'm way more engaged with my kids than I have been. When I say I'm always engaged with my kids, but my kids get like 1,000% dad right now, which is, I got little ham radios for my kids, and I'm, you know, doing radio checks, and we're doing like fishing, and we're more active in the garden, and I'm getting up in the morning and I'm like supercharging them, like tickles and stories, the things that mean a lot to them. But yeah, sometimes you don't get to them on your regular work cycle. I'm making sure to hit all those boxes now because they need me to be that guy that makes sure that they're not affected negatively in any way as far as their psychology. They're 3 and 6. They can't feel the weight of this fucking thing.
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, because earlier I was like taking some jokes at my own expense about sleeping right now and how much I've been sleeping. But to give a little more depth into that, there was also a little bit of a conscious decision there where I do better. I do better as a dad when I don't drink at all. I never drank to the point where like you get drunk around your kids, never, but it would be, the hangovers.
Yeah.
Right. And hangovers, really the first thing that takes a hit is my patience when I'm hungover. Mm-hmm. And then lack of sleep takes a hit at my patience and focus. And so, and talking about how I've been sleeping a lot, it was kind of conscientious to sleep a lot through this, because it's a lot of stress, and I just thought I'd do better with my family if I was well rested, which has kind of been being true. But we had also have been spending a lot of time talking about, this will be our kids are at a very young, impressionable age, and this will be a thing.
Yeah.
That this will be a thing they talk about for forever.
Yeah.
Just because of where they're at in their age. And we,
well, that's interesting. I was just thinking that my kids, by the time they're 18, it'll just be like this little blip in their early childhood.
How old are your kids?
6 and 8.
Okay. Yeah.
I think that the year that they didn't go to, that they got pulled out of school and were homeschooled, and there was like, it was introduced this idea that you have to introduce to them that there's, without trying to use these words, that it's dangerous to go into other people's houses right now.
right,
to not go super close to your friends, to if you go to the river launch, to put in a boat that you don't go over and talk to the dude fishing.
Right.
I feel like this is going to stick. I feel like it'll stick. And so we've really tried to, like, me and my wife as a couple a little bit, have tried to talk about how much we early on a few weeks ago hit on, like, that we're going to try to switch to, I think I talked about this last week, we're going to try to switch to more of a need to know basis.
Yeah.
With our kids. And give them the information they need day in, day out.
Mm-hmm.
But not spend a whole lot of time talking about different projections from different models and what this might mean. And, you know, just try to keep it normal, but there's a lot of not normal.
Yeah. There's a lot of not normal. And at least for us, you know, we've just decided we don't talk about it. So we don't talk about it around the kids. We don't talk, 3 and 6 is, I think it's a little bit too young, and they can already sense that things are wonky. And, you know, when we look at it as a, when my wife and I talk about it, it's at night. So we talk about it at night before we go to bed and some of the things and how it affects our life. But, you know, as kind of going back to where, what I was thinking about earlier was, I have to go self for the most part first, and then family, make sure that my family's taken care of, and I can start taking care of the company more effectively. Because once those boxes are full for me, and I'm very kind of a linear thinker in that regard, if I've got everything kind of checked across the board and I'm psychologically comfortable being, you know, a leader and a positive influence, then I can move to the next one. Then I go to my company, and then I go from company to the community. So I have to fill up every one of those and make sure that they're directly proportionate and representing energy. And I think that, and not only do I think, that's what I put out to my company too, is, you know, you have to take care of yourself, your family, the company, and then the community. The community is the last one in the line, but it's not unimportant to us. And we do have to directly consider how we can help others. And I don't want to get on a soapbox, right? But it's, you know, if we have psychological stability, leadership, and the things that we're plugged in and we've taken care of, then we need to be out in the community from my company's perspective, trying to inject more positivity and do good for the people that are in need. So my wife and I were literally just talking about this last week. We're like, we got to get down and donate blood. We've got to do some of these things that we know are really important, that also impact the community outside of what we're doing just for the company.
Yep. Yanni and I have for a couple of years now, not because of any particular love for the company at all, but we've plugged up Starbucks Via as being a great alternative to Noah's Cafe or Folgers Crystals.
Yeah.
And it changed, like, we feel that Starbucks Via, like, fundamentally changed the landscape for backpackers and backpack hunters.
Mm-hmm.
I'm switching though, dude, but walk me through your hunting, your walk me through your product line, man.
Well, you know, it's funny. I actually did not bring this because we were going to be on the podcast, but that's what I'm drinking right now is Black Rifle Coffee's Black Powder.
Dude, that's a good name.
I spent a couple years on this. You and I were talking about it the other day where I didn't have a really good instant option, and it really annoyed me because I was taking competitors' instant options with me. And
that's got to burn, right?
Dude, it's horrible. I was doing the lightweight fly fishing trip in West Yellowstone, and I was carrying a competitor's coffee with me because I was more concerned with shaving the grams than I was with making my own coffee. And so I spent a couple years really trying to work on my instant. And I would say it is the best instant out there. Obviously I'm biased, but it took me a long time. I had to go there's only a few different companies that do what's called micro grinding. So they actually grind real coffee into the instant coffee. It's a combination of freeze drying and micro grinds that are ultimately put together to make the best instant coffee. Other instant coffees, a lot, they can be just kind of an amalgamation of different chemicals that make a taste profile similar to coffee.
Yeah.
So, we really, when I say we spent a lot of time on this product. The other product that I came out with for backpacking, hunting specifically, was tea bags. So the standard old-looking tea bag, but we filled them with coffee, and we've got a different filtration paper system so you can dip it and create, you know, a dark cup of coffee or a light cup of coffee depending on where you want to land that. And then, of course, I've got like pour over devices and all these other things. I'm the guy that develops all those products for the most part. When I say any product that you see from Black Rifle Coffee, there's two names on the lower right hand corner, and there's either my name, which is about 80% of the products, and then there's Matt Best's name, and he's contributing a good portion of what we do in the product line as well. So I do all the coffees though. So I do all the coffees, 100% of any coffee. I profile it. I cup it. I not only do that, but I cup it against the specs every year. So I cup every one of our profiles against my original specs in my original notes that I developed some of these profiles in 2008. So I cup it against my original notes from 2008.
To make sure you didn't get like mission creep or yep, drift.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 And if there is, then it's intentional. I've changed it intentionally.
And then you guys got a good decaf for old Giannis here?
Yeah. 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 We do. I do. It's a decaf. And we do it in a couple different options, but it's a Swiss water Colombian decaf. A lot of people, you know, they, because of our marketing, they think we're just good marketers. I'm like, man, I have a roaster in Nashville that I built last year. I have a roaster in Salt Lake City. We go direct to source. I've got direct farm relationships with the majority of my coffees. I have what's called Q graders, which are like roast masters, Q graders in the company, myself, like, so we really take pride in those two things, like roasting coffee and creating great marketing. And then, you know, I think everything else kind of takes care of itself at the end of the day.
Is there a decaf in the instant too?
No, but there will be in September, depending, as we look at manufacturing dates continuing to be pushed back, based on shutdowns across the United States. I'm hoping that it's going to be in September. Like last elk season, I did it was a Costa Rican black honey, and I called it Flying Elk for elk season. And this year, I'm doing Flying Elk 2.0 during elk season. So every year, I kind of curate different coffees for different seasons as well. So they're different. And I took one to Moose Camp this year, which was an amazing cup of coffee, but it's so funny because you're out in like, you know, an old trapper cabin with a bunch of, you know, salty guides, and you're like hand grinding coffee and bringing it up to temperature. You're like, what are you doing, man? You just make some coffee. Come on.
Well, man, it's terrible that we're not, like normally we'd be sitting there hanging out. But we'll have to put that on hold.
We could have a cup of coffee.
We'd be having a cup of coffee together.
I know. I love making it. So I'd be in there, like, in the studio, hand grinding this stuff.
Oh, I could smell it.
You probably weigh it per cup, don't you, Evan?
I do. Yeah. I weigh it every day. Every cup. It doesn't matter what it is. So it's all proper water to coffee ratios based on gram weight and also temperature of water.
All right, we're gonna look.
I just lost half your audience.
You did. I'm just being mindful. No, not at all. I don't mean that. I just mean I'm just disappointed because I'd like to. Well, I want to hang out. I want to hang out sometime and do something fun. I'm just feeling like psychologically. We called our last episode I miss my friends, which is, I didn't realize that it would be so hard for me, but it'd be cool. Yeah. I'd like to meet you sometime and hang out. I appreciate you coming on the show.
I would love to. I mean, two more seconds of my rambling, but I'm a huge fan of the show, guys. Like, I love what you guys do over there. You know, I watched like Das Boot. I think I was telling you the on via text. I was like, that's the best show. My daughters watch it. So either way, like, I mean, I'd love to hang out with you guys. I it's a huge honor to be here because you're creating some of the best content on the internet. And I don't say that to hardly anybody ever.
Thank you.
So,
but yeah, man, enjoy your time. So you're holed up in Texas.
I'm holed up for at least the next 6 weeks. We're going to just flatten the curve with the family. And I'm here in San Antonio. I'm going to be hunting with my daughters, pretty much hunting and fishing every day with the daughters and making sure the company stays on the tracks.
Good. Have a good turkey hunt tonight.
I'll try. Well, I can't wait to get back up there, you guys. I'll definitely try to hit you up so I can come in because I'd love to see you guys in person.
Yeah, we'd like to have you. Our opening day of turkey season is getting ramrodded by a snowstorm, but we'll see how that goes.
So, oh, seriously?
Yeah, it's bad. It's been beautiful, man, but like Saturday just goes to hell. So we'll climb out. We have a long season. We'll be good.
Good.
All right. Thank you very much for coming on. We're going to as soon as all this bullshit ends, we're going to reschedule you and get you up.
Man, I can't wait. I would love to.
Thank you. Evan Hay for everyone. Black Rifle Coffee Company.
Oh, should we find out where we can get some Black Rifle, Steve, if we wanted to try some out?
Yeah, give me a pitch or tell people how to find you.
Yeah, go to blackriflecoffee.com. Join the club. There's no better way to experience Black Rifle Coffee than joining the Black Rifle Coffee subscription.
There it is. Well done.
There it is.
Okay. Thank you very much, man.
Thanks, guys.
See you.